There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Malala Yousafzai once said, "Do not wait for someone else to come and speak for you. It is you who can change the world." Hello, I'm Claire Tonti and welcome to this podcast called Just Make the Thing. My guest today is Carly Finlay. This show is all about how to start a thing and keep on making it. And goodness me, Carly makes many things. She is a blogger, a writer, a speaker, and an appearance activist. She challenges people's thinking about what it's like to have a visibly different appearance. She's brave and funny. She's written for many publications, including The Guardian, The Age, and The Sydney Morning Herald, Daily Life, The ABC, Mamma Mia, and Frankie Magazine. She's used her blog to write about her skin condition, ichthyosis, as well as promote causes such as Love Your Sister and Donate Life. Carly was named as one of Australia's most influential women in the Australian Financial Review and Westpac 100 Women of Influence Awards for 2014. Man, I was nervous meeting this incredible person. She works so hard. That's what struck me the most about Carly's body of work. How hard she works, how dedicated she is to promoting the causes that she supports. And also how funny and creative she is. I love how she uses color. I love her clothes. I love her Instagram posts about food. And that's how I found her on Instagram, at Carly Finlay. If you don't follow her, go and follow her now. She has so much joy and insight. And I think also intelligence to bring to the debate about diverse voices, about growing up as a woman now in 2018. And she challenges us to create more inclusive spaces for everybody. I've started using image descriptions on my Instagram because after I had this interview, I realized that our Planet Broadcasting Network could be much more inclusive than it is. So small steps, but there are things that we can all do, I think, to have more empathy. And Carly teaches us that. So here she is. We recorded in a really hot room. We were both exhausted because the heat was crazy, and Carly has trouble regulating her body temperature, but she was an amazing trooper and stuck through all of my questions. So here she is in all her glory, Carly Finlay. Hello, Carly Finlay.
Hello, Claire. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to put my headphones on. Hang on.
Okay. I know, it's so fancy.
It is.
Cool. Well, you have been rushing in the rain from a speech today, haven't you? Where were you talking?
I was talking at, I don't even know the place. Don't tell them that. I was talking at a law firm, and it was my last event for the year, so really happy to be finishing work for the year.
Yes.
So, yeah, did a speech for International Day of People with Disability, which was on the 3rd of December.
Oh,
so,
yeah. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
So I wanted to ask you, my first question really was around, because this show is about how to start a thing and keep on making it.
Mm-hmm.
When did you know that you were a writer?
When I wrote a book at school, and I say book very loosely, it was some 5 bits of cardboard punched together with some, you know, string.
It's still a book.
Yes. So that's how I knew I was a writer when I was about 5. But I do remember my kindergarten teacher said to me that I didn't write properly because I think I wrote a sentence like "the good dog went into the big night," and she said that didn't make sense.
That's kind of poetic to me.
Yeah. Me too, and look where I am now.
Yeah, yeah, she didn't know anything. Clearly she wasn't a writer. What do you love to write about the most?
Well, I used to blog a lot, and I used to like the freedom of just having an idea and then writing it down and not having, you know, not having the burden of the time or, you know, the pressure to get everything right or whatever, so just to have that freedom. So I guess I enjoyed writing in that way the most, but certainly it hasn't changed in what content I write. So I write a lot about disability, appearance, diversity. I think I've got an idea to write a blog post actually, so That hasn't happened for a long time because I've just been writing my book and writing media. So I think I've got an idea. I actually wrote one dot point in my phone before for a blog post.
Oh, wow.
So that's good.
Is that how you come up with your ideas? Do you record them in your phone as you go?
Yeah. So if I lost my phone or my iNotes or whatever they're called, I'd just be dead, you know, because they're just all there. Everything I've ever thought of for the last 8 years are just all in those notes. Just record them. I don't verbally record much.
But just
text it into my phone. And then they're, you know, synced on every device, which is useful.
That's so useful.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you were that five-year-old and you were writing, where did your ideas come from, do you think?
Yeah, I think fairy tales and other stories I read. Do you remember when you were in little, like kinder and preschool, there were those really big books, those giant books, and the teacher would read them? Yes. Yeah, those kind of books, like Grug and Spot, Meg and Mog, Miffy, all those kids' books. Yeah.
Oh, I used to be a primary school teacher.
Oh,
yeah.
That's the best.
The big books are the best.
Yeah.
Because it's the images and I think when you're a child, the world just comes so alive with words.
Yeah.
Buzzing everywhere.
Yeah. I remember the hippopotamus on my roof eating cake. Do you remember that book?
Oh, yes. I read that to my son all the time.
Oh, so good. So all of those sorts of books maybe. Also my mum used to tell stories and my dad as well. And I wrote about it in my book, how they would tell stories and I would help them finish them. And
what are your parents like?
My mum is very much like me. I think we're very fiery. Sometimes, you know, we have heated arguments probably because we're so alike. My mum's very, very outgoing, very bubbly, very talkative. My dad's, he's quite serious and I think I'm serious as well in that way. And he's also very, I wouldn't say academic, but he's very smart.
So you're a mix of both.
Yeah.
So fieriness of your mum but then the kind of academic seriousness of your dad.
Yep. Mm.
How, because I wanted to talk a little bit today and I want to make sure I get this right. So you have a condition, I'm not telling you what you have, but called ichthyosis.
Mm-hmm, good pronunciation.
Yeah, correct. Mm. And obviously that's not anywhere near all of who you are.
Mm-mm.
At all, and you're so accomplished. How did you kind of come to know that you had ichthyosis when you were a child?
I don't know. I think my parents were very matter of fact, like this is what I've got. You know, there was a lot of time spent with doctors, so I learned those medical terms very early. And I guess maybe I knew when the other children treated me differently, perhaps, you know, with bullying and exclusion. So maybe that's how I knew that there were social barriers in having ichthyosis. And I also felt that there were medical problems when I realised how painful it is. So it's a skin condition. I guess that was the two things that taught me, knowing when I had it because I was in hospital or going to the doctors a lot and feeling the physical pain, you know, especially when having a bath, it was very present then, and also being excluded by kids. Yeah, probably from when I was about three, I'd say.
Mm.
But my parents have never hidden it. I mean, not that you could, but I know that there are parents who won't tell their children of their diagnosis. Mine were never like that. The very matter of fact, this is how it is, it's going to be okay, get on with it. Yeah.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, because it strikes me that you have so much resilience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in order to make stuff, you need to have a huge amount of resilience.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, because I think people give up when, you know, they get a rejection or don't know how much you have to work before, I don't know, you're getting somewhere or you feel you're getting somewhere. So I think that resilience from having ichthyosis has really helped me in resilience in other areas of life. Mm. Yeah.
When you get up in the morning,
mm-hmm.
what do you need to do to get out of the house?
Check Facebook.
Correct. Instagram.
Yep.
Excellent. Brush your teeth. Cool.
Done. You know, we were just talking about the filters before, and wouldn't that be good if I could just like filter my sore skin out before having to do all the stuff that I normally have to do? Is there an app for that? So basically, I work for Melbourne Fringe, and we start work at 10, which is really great. So it means I don't have to get up as early, so I can sort of get up at 7 and have a shower and just put moisturiser, like paraffin, over my whole body, and then often I'll go to bed, back to bed, and I'll do freelance work until 9, until I have to leave, and then I leave for work. That's it, really. So basically it's just having a shower and putting on a lot of oily moisturiser. That's it, yeah.
Excellent. And then... And so I guess because it puts it in perspective, I think, doesn't it, when you realise everyone has stuff that they do before they leave the house, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't necessarily have to take heaps of tablets or anything. It's just taking antihistamine most days. And if I am sore, I mean, that can take a bit of time if I'm sore, like wanting to rest or using salt in the shower or putting dressings on, but it's not, I mean, it's not an imposition. But it is good starting later, because when I started work earlier, like 8:30, then I would sometimes feel like, oh, I'm a bit sore, can I come in, you know, 9:30 or something, if I want to be slow. So, yeah, it's not anything big deal. But I do find when I'm with friends that are putting on makeup, I just feel like, oh, are you done yet? Like I've been done for 30 minutes.
That's true. We spend a lot of time. So you don't wear makeup?
No, not really. Sometimes I wear lipstick and sometimes I wear nail polish, but no, not anything. I do want my dream. I don't have any eyelashes, and that would be my ultimate dream, to have eyelashes that are really exaggerated.
Oh, like Rosie Waterland has those, like, really long ones.
I know, right? Then I saw she got an eye infection, so maybe I don't want those.
No. I've got really straight eyelashes, and I tried to curl them once, because if I tried to put fake ones on, I just get 2 sets.
Yeah.
And I spent an hour under like a curling rod thing, and then I got out, they just went straight back to being straight. So I did love, though, because I follow you on Instagram, and I highly recommend going to follow you, because you're so entertaining, but also write so beautifully. But I always love your outfits.
Thank you.
What does fashion mean to you?
I just think it's fun. I think it's a good way to express yourself, and I really like colour. I wrote the other day, like, is this outfit too subtle? And it was like I had green stockings, pink shoes and a really colourful dress. And someone actually said, no, I think you need coloured sleeves, because I just had black underneath. Yeah, it's just fun and expressive and good way to, I guess, looking professional as well. Like, remember my dad was saying to me when I was young, I should try and present myself really well so that people don't have that low expectation of me. So that's kind of always stuck. Yeah.
That's a huge lesson for everyone, I think.
I think so. And I think, you know, we disabled people have the, shoulder the low expectations of everybody, thinking that we're, you know, someone to be pitied or someone to be placed on a pedestal for just getting out of bed. But I think we can play a hand in how we're seen by making an effort in how we present ourselves. And that doesn't mean being vain or, you know, necessarily having the best, most expensive clothes, but just taking a bit of time to make ourselves look and feel good.
Taking pride.
Absolutely, yeah. And also, I mean, I wear a lot of layers because I don't want to get sunburnt and I don't want to be cold. I find it really hard to regulate my temperature. So I'm always cold when it's warm, or, you know, can't cool myself down when it's really warm. So I do wear a lot of layers, and I like that, the colour that I can create with all the layers.
Yeah. That's the thing that struck me the most when I love your Instagram, because it's always so bright and so colourful and there's so much going on. It's so awesome. And it's really hot in this studio.
It is really hot.
Yeah, so you need
I've got a drink, so okay. I can't. Oh, I can probably unzip my dress if I need to.
Yeah,
I've got another layer.
We'll get to know each other really quick. So I guess my next question, this is going to sound kind of funny. Can you explain ableism to our listeners?
Yeah, so ableism is discrimination towards disabled people. So it's the stuff like, thinking that we don't need parking spaces because we don't look disabled, or even when the government talks about people on the disability support pension being a burden, or when the media writes about that, it's about, you know, not standing up for someone on a train. Lots of different things, all types of discrimination. It's like slurs, like the R word, the M word. You know, making fun of people, it's excluding people, it's, you know, yeah.
It strikes me that you're really ballsy, like you don't suffer fools lightly.
No.
And that you aren't afraid to speak your mind.
Although I feel now, one of the lessons I've really learned now in working in access and inclusion. I do that for Melbourne Fringe. I'm very good at doing it, advocating for other people, but not so much myself. And so the other day I was doing something where I had to organise a bunch of people to work for another company, and that company didn't treat those people so well. So I got on the phone and yelled at them. And yet when I'm doing, like, trying to advocate for myself, you know, asking if we can get an Auslan interpreter at an event, for example, I'm always a bit apologetic or not as ballsy as I would be for someone else, because I don't want to be seen as the demanding, annoying diva, because I think that can be really hard to be placed in that. But yeah, I am. I'm, you know, I just say what a woman at the speech I just gave, actually, she said, oh, you know, I want to talk to you about the word disability. I'm not happy with it. My son has a disability, but I don't like the word. And I said, well, you know, it's a factual word. It's not an insult. It's a neutral descriptor. It's part of his identity. It's not his whole identity. And you've got to be proud and teach him pride and not use euphemisms like special needs or disability. I don't know whether that's the answer that she wanted, but I gave it anyway.
Well, I guess it strikes me that you're a truth teller, and it's important, I think, to be able to speak your truth and explain to people. What do you believe about the power of language?
I think I was listening to Malala yesterday, the day before I went to see Malala.
Oh, I'm so jealous.
Oh, my God.
I saw you go.
She was so amazing. And she just said, like, words are the biggest weapon, the most powerful weapon we can use. You know, they're, I guess, you know, we can use them for bad, and they can be harmful, but they certainly can change people's opinions and sway people. And, you know, writing letters or articles or complaints, they can really help change things. You know, words have gotten me very far, I think, in terms of a career and in terms of being respected and for me, learning new things as well. Like, you know, writing involves reading, so you have to read lots of other perspectives and to form your own views. So, yeah, it's been, I think they're pretty good. I like words. Yeah. Sometimes I make words up and then Adam will say, that's not a word. Adam's my husband. He'll say, that's not a word. It can be.
Yeah, well, I'm playing his own words. All words are made up
by someone. Exactly.
At some point.
Exactly.
Who are the people other than Malala, obviously, the writers that you love or inspire you?
I really liked this year. I really liked Lee Sales' Any Ordinary Day book. Have you read that?
Yes.
So amazing. Wow. Yeah. She was incredible. Really liked her book. I really like, I read a lot of disability writers, Emily Liddell from America, Ariel Henley from America again, who's got a facial difference. They're really great disability activists. I really like reading Clementine Ford's work on feminism. I like Jamila Rizvi's work on being a woman in the workforce. I really like Yasmin Abdel-Magid. I think she wrote a great piece on being a model minority that I really liked. So that's the idea of people put her up on a pedestal, I guess, as a person in the minority. And she, I guess, in some people's eyes failed, and though she didn't, I don't think she failed at all, but, she felt like she had to leave the country. She was talking about the pressure of that. She wrote a really good piece for Teen Vogue on that. I really like Ben Law's writing, Celeste Little's writing, lots of Australian activist writer people I like.
What do you, I guess this is a bit of a funny question, but I've wanted to ask you about the title of your book. Why is it called Say Hello?
Yeah, so Say Hello, it was my agent, Jacinta, came up with that, because when I did my book proposal, so in writing a book, I had a few publishers approach me, and then I got an agent, Jacinta and Danielle, Jacinta DeMarze, and they helped me put a book proposal together. And when I was writing all the themes of the book and different chapters to submit to publishers, one of the themes that kept on coming up was people would ask me questions about my skin, questions about my face, but they would forget their niceties. So I often get questions like, what's happened to you, or what have you done to yourself, or have you been sunburnt? And they don't say hello. And when other people are greeted, they're often greeted by hello. So I wanted to invite people to say hello rather than asking these questions. Or if they must ask these questions, which I really hope they don't, I hope that it's, you know, politeness is used.
It's a lovely thought, and also something I just haven't ever thought about before, that right, that people would be so rude. Like, that to me, that surprises me.
Yeah, it still surprises me, I think, you know, because I feel like I should be able to go down the street and not be asked. But, yeah, people just forget. And I think for disabled people, our bodies are often not our own property. Our bodies are medicalised and by the medical industry. But also because of shows like Embarrassing Bodies or that awful doctor, what's that, Dr. Pimple Pop, for example, you know, where people watch that kind of stuff as entertainment, we in the street then become people's infotainment. You know, we're expected to answer questions to satisfy their curiosity. And so when parents tell me, oh, I encourage my child to go up and ask what's wrong with that person who's in a wheelchair, I say, well, it's fine to be curious, but we don't always want to answer the question. So you have to tell your child that maybe we deserve the right to be approached on our own terms or to answer on our own terms. So I think saying hello is a way maybe to break the ice. I often get people comment, I think they're thinking I'm sunburnt. And so when it's super hot, they'll start breaking the ice by saying, oh, it's a really hot day, isn't it? And I'll say, yeah, it is. And then they'll say, oh, so what's happened to you? or have you been sunburnt? So that, you know, just be nice and treat people like you would treat someone else that's not disabled, I think. And it's not inviting condescending talk or anything. It's, saying hello, asking, you know, how someone is, not commenting or needing to know why someone is.
The way they are.
It
strikes me that we all have things about us because human beings are problematic and fragile and complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And internally we all have things going on with us that are challenging or hard,
mm-hmm.
but you don't necessarily see it on the surface. Mm-hmm. And so then people aren't asking you blatantly. And last year I fell over and smashed my teeth in on a brick on the road.
Oh, gosh.
And so I've got three missing teeth in the front of my mouth. And it occurred to me for a while I couldn't put my teeth in. And it was the first time I'd kind of entered that space really where it's something that you're conscious of when you're walking into somewhere. And it also made me realise that, again, that lesson, like what Lise Alice talks about in her book too, that you don't know what's around the corner in life.
Mm.
And also that people can, you know, people are in the end much more worried about their own stuff than yours, even though they can say offensive things initially.
Yeah, I think that there's two things I was going to say there. One thing I feel like when people comment or tell me that they couldn't handle looking like me or asking if there's a cure or whatever, that's a very clear projection of their own feelings of how their vanity onto me and their feelings around looking different. But also I think people don't realise how the impact of asking as well, because for me, for you, it might be the first time you've seen someone like me, but for me it's the fifth time I've encountered it that day. And also if someone acquires a facial difference or, you know, a disability through an accident or through violence, they have to relive that every time they explain it to a stranger. So, you know, is it that stranger's right to know? I mentioned in the book a friend who said that she has a missing eye due to domestic violence, and every time someone asks her, then she thinks about that time where she lost her eye. And it's not fair on her to have to explain.
No, absolutely.
Mm.
So I wanted to change tack because I know it's getting very hot in here. What is it like to actually write a book? Like, what is that like?
It's really, really hard. So I wrote a book. I wrote most of my book on my iPad in my notes as well.
Really?
So I've got a whole folder in my notes, like just book, and then I just file those, like each chapter into there. And so I thought it would be really easy. I thought, oh, yeah, I'll just write like I would blog posts and then put them together somehow. And it's not like that at all. So I wrote all these chapters in my book, for my book, in my iPad. And then I met this woman at Connie Johnson's funeral, at Connie Johnson's public memorial. I met her on the steps of the memorial, and she's an artist, and she said, what do you do? And I told her I was a writer and I was writing my book at the time. This was in September last year. And she said, oh, I have a studio. Come to my studio and you can write. You can be our guest for a month. So then I wrote the rest of the book, on pretty much the whole book, really. Let's not lie. I had all these notes in iPad, and then I took my MacBook in and I wrote all of the book, nearly all of the book, in that studio, which was lovely because I could just, you know, do it at the table, whereas normally I just write in bed. And but I realised I didn't have enough words in all my notes to make up this, you know, in like 6 weeks to the end of the book. The deadline, I had, you know, like 40,000 words and it had to be 80,000. Oh, God. So anyway, so it's really hard and you have to dig into your soul, I guess, and think about things that you might not want to. And also, you know, I don't want to be whiny or seem entitled and I want to be a bit balanced. Like I want to recognise my failings as well in writing, you know, so saying I'm not always a nice person or not always a good friend or whatever. So you've got to admit things that possibly aren't nice to admit. And the editing process is really hard too because I think, I don't know how many edits there are now for now that it's done, but I think there were definitely five rounds of editing. And there's this edit called the structural edit. That's the worst. So the first edit comes back and then they tell you what else they want you to write. And then the second edit, the structural edit, is where they move everything around. So they say that, like, this paragraph in chapter 5 should be in chapter 2 and then, you know, we want more written here. And anyway, that was really, really hard to get all that, and I was still doing it on my iPad again. Don't write your book on your iPad. The moral of this story is get a really, really big TV screen and plug your computer into that so you can see it on the wall and you can move everything around. I think that would have been much easier. If I'm doing another book, that's what I will do. I don't know. I think it's so – there's so many words. I think my book is from like 92,000 words or something. It's 360-something pages. And I don't really remember what I've written where either. Like I can't remember what chapters what now because I did have to go back and reread it before media stuff, so I remembered. But it's a long process. You know, it's 2 years of writing.
Wow.
So for me it was. For other people it might not be. It's just really long and it's nothing like writing a blog because blogs are just discrete, you know, pieces of work. And this, you have to tie it together. Yeah, and then there's a lot of imposter syndrome as well, thinking that, oh, my God, why am I writing a book? I can't do this. I have to give back the money.
Yeah,
yeah, there's lots of self-doubt, lots of worrying that it's not good enough, lots of – I've lost a few friends as well, which has been really hard.
Wow.
Yeah, so, you know, too mainstream, sold out, blah, blah. That's probably been the hardest thing, I would say. Like, it's been quite a lot. Like, it's been a really successful year for me, but it's been a really lonely time. So
yeah.
Mm.
That's what someone else said, that Glennon Doyle, who I follow,
mm-hmm.
said that when you're on an adventure and you're scaring yourself and you put yourself out there, that you do lose friends too.
Mm. Really, yeah, I think people perhaps only want to support you until you get to a certain level of success. I don't know. Anyway, they probably weren't friends to start with. But, yeah, that's been pretty hard, I think. That's been one of the hardest things of writing the book. One of the best things, the really nice things that happened was doing the photos for the book, and that's not really involved – the writing's not really involved in that. But, you know, my parents live in the country, so I got them to get all my school photos and all my photos from my childhood. And I think they sent me about 600. And I didn't even think I had that many of when I was a kid. I certainly don't remember having my photo taken very much. So it was really nice to look back on that and see the type of childhood I had. So that was nice.
Yeah.
Finding those photos and, yeah, so that's been a good bit. I think also the nice bit has been, like, with the editors, and they leave notes in the margin and things, you know, like cheering my mum on. Like, I think my mum's got her own fan club because, yeah, she's so great. But that's been, yeah, it's been good. And also the time it takes is a really long time. And then it all happens really quickly as well. So I didn't even know that the book had gone to print. I remember sending an email to the editor going, oh, can you just make this one last change? She said, no, when I told you the book's gone to print last week, I meant it. Yeah, so anyway, it's fine. So you kind of just have to let it go.
Yeah. How did you go from writing a blog to being Kylie Finlay book author?
From writing every day. Like, right, you know, showing up, writing every day. So I used to write a blog most days. My blog used to get attended to most days. Now it hasn't. It's been very neglected. I went from blogging for a long time, since 2001, I would say I started blogging, not on this blog. This blog's nearly 9 years old. Then I just submitted stuff to the media, got writing for the media a bit, so Daily Life, SBS, ABC, Mamma Mia, Frankie, stuff like that. And then just keeping on writing and keeping on being visible and putting myself forward and putting others forward too, you know, that kind of promoting others is very reciprocal. Mm-hmm. So then it just, you know, it certainly didn't happen. I'd been blogging for 7 years before people approached me with, we want to publish your book. So, yeah, like, you know, I've been blogging on this blog for 7 years.
Yeah, so did you write a submission for this book to publishers or did you?
Yeah. Oh, so I got in 2016, around this time actually, at the end of 2016, I was on Christmas holidays and I was reading Clem Ford's Fight Like a Girl and Lindy West's Thrill, and I thought, I want to write my own, I think it's time. And so I made all these notes in my iPad, on my phone probably, and I made notes about what I wanted in the book. And then I got back to work, and at that time I was really struggling at work, I just wasn't happy there. And I'd worked like 3 days a week and it was from home and the rest of the team were in Melbourne. I'm Sydney rather, and I felt really isolated being in Melbourne alone. And the highlight of that week, like, I sort of thought, oh, it's just only the start of the year and, you know, I'm already feeling miserable at work. And the highlight of that week was a publisher followed me on Twitter. It wasn't a big publisher, like it wasn't a very well-known publisher, a small publisher followed me. And then I got an email later that day from this publisher to say, we're interested in publishing your book. And I thought, how do you even know I'm writing a book? Anyway, it's funny how, you know, if you write something down, it happens, or, you know, you're accountable to yourself or to other people. And so just before that, so in about September 2016, so 3 months earlier, I had gone to this women's writers thing at the Wheeler Centre where I met an agent. I didn't even meet her there. I was just live tweeting the event. And so the agent, Jacinta, she thanked me via Twitter to say and said, oh, I'd love to meet you. And I said, I'm going overseas next week because I was going on my honeymoon. And I said, I'll catch up with you when I get back. And I never did. But then when I got this publishing request, I emailed her and I said, I don't know if you remember me, but I was tweeting you at this event last year and now I've had a publisher interest, what should I do? And she said, oh, we want to sign you up, so we'll sign you up onto our
roster.
Yes. Stable, I guess. And so then she said, and we'll help you put a book proposal together. So I said, okay. And then the next week I had an interview for 200 women. Do you know the book 200 Women? It's 200 women from around the world, and we were photographed, and so I was one of those in the book. And the people that were taking my photograph said, a lady from the publisher's coming to your interview. She's really interested in publishing your book. And I thought, well, how does she know I'm writing a book? Anyway, so then I told Jacinta again, oh, I've had some interest from this book, this publisher. And then so we put together the thing. It took a long time. It's kind of like writing a grant, writing a book proposal. So you write down, like, your synopsis, your aims, your audience, who your audience is, who you want it to be, what other books are on the market, three chapters, not your bio, I can't remember what else. But anyway, so it's just kind of like writing a grant, I guess. And then, so we sent that out in March, and then by May I had 5 yeses. We sent it to 9 people. I had 5 yeses and 3 noes and a no and a I don't know. So, so that was exciting. I had to choose. And it's like choosing a puppy, you know, where you have won all of them because they're all, you know, they're all great. And then you get to know the people because they all take you out to lunch or you have meetings or – and then I had to say no to four of them. And you still keep that, you know, the relationships with them. I'm working with one I did an interview with an author from one of the publishers once, and then, you know, I've seen other publishers around, and so that was really nice. So I chose HarperCollins, and they've been amazing to work with. So, so that's
incredible.
Yeah, and then I used that chapter summary, the chapter outline for the book as well. So that's how I organised my work when I first started. So I would say something, you know, like, today I'm going to work on chapter 3, whatever that was. Then and then just write to that, you know, 4,000 words or whatever. So,
that's how you've kept it from back then when it was in the notes in your phone to now?
No, well, it's a lot different. It's a lot different.
Probably not in the notes.
Some of the chapters are still called the same, I think.
Wow.
Mm.
Don't you believe in the universe?
Yeah, well, like can't, I didn't, but then I did. I didn't, but then I did, you know. Even when I, you know, like when I was thinking about, I used to work for the government for a long time and it was very well paying and it was very secure. And then I quit to go to this part-time job, the one that I wasn't happy with. And but before that, I made a list of things that I was going to do to make money. So it's literally a list of how to make money, all these different things. And then my husband said, oh, you should pitch to big business. And then the next day, this company emailed me to go, oh, we really like you to put in a proposal for us to do training, to deliver training to 400 staff. And I'm like, okay. And then I thought, oh, my God, how do I do a tender? I don't know how to write a tender. And so I rang my old manager from the government going, how do I write a tender? And then I got it, and it just finished up this year, this last month. But it was really great to be able to deliver training over, you know, every month for 2 years.
Yeah.
And I'm re-pitching, actually, so fingers crossed I get it. But, yeah.
So could you explain what a tender is?
It's just like a proposal to work for someone, and then they discuss it with the managers, and then they choose who is the best value,
and I got it. And it's Carly.
Apparently. Yeah. So, yeah, it was really fun. And, yeah, I think that experience to have that money while I was writing my book was really good because it's really good money to do that kind of training, and I could just you know, not worry so much. But now I've got a part-time job. I'm pretty stretched for time.
Gosh, it strikes me that you're really good at hustling.
I feel like it. I don't know. I don't think so. I used to see a lot of bloggers and influencers around the time when I was more, you know, blogging the most, say 2010, 11, 12, when just before Instagram influencers had come, and lots of bloggers would try to work with brands, and I was always rejected. No one wanted a chronic illness blogger, which was really sad, I thought. It was pretty discriminatory. That's ableism. And I think that, you know, they weren't someone with a certain image, and I've spoken a lot about that, about how I felt really left out, and like all of my blogging peers were getting opportunities, they were going overseas, they were working with brands, and even like, even though I had the same level of readership as them, the brands weren't interested. And so that's, I guess, why I chose to go my own way with the media and with pursuing my writing rather than writing to ads, you know, writing kind of to sponsored posts. But the other day I did a talk in Sydney to a bunch of chronic illness influencers, and I did a talk in my pyjamas, and I was saying how, you know, you too can work in your pyjamas and be a, you know, be like
successful.
Me.
Yeah,
be successful. And I said, you know, it doesn't matter if you're too sore or too unwell, just, you know, do your work in your pyjamas. So I did this talk in my pyjamas, and lots of people came up to me afterwards to say that's really great. And then Peter Alexander sent me some pyjamas. Yay! It was really exciting.
Oh, my God. Isn't it amazing the way I totally believe in the universe and how things all come around.
Yeah.
But you have to kind of stick at what feels right.
Yeah.
For you.
And I think, you know, had I worked with those brands, they wouldn't have fit anyway. You know, like the makeup brands, I don't use makeup. They were chocolate and I really like chocolate. So, you know, you have to work it for you. I feel now I have to be more of a hustler. And sometimes, you know, someone will say, oh, we don't have the budget to pay you for that, so I'll just go down and meet their budget. You know, not too much out of my budget, but, yeah, you've got to be. And I think working for yourself, you'd probably find this as well. And I talk with a friend as well. When you're an employee, you get stuff done for you. You get your HR done for you. You get your payroll done and all that. But when you're a self-employed person, you got to do it all yourself, and it's really hard.
It's so hard.
Yeah.
It's so confusing. Yeah. Oh, I still have to wrap my head around tax, and now we've got people working for us too, and that's a whole other thing. Mm. Yeah, but I wouldn't have it any other way, and it strikes me that you might not have it any other way either.
Yeah, I think quitting my government job and doing my own thing's been the best. Yeah, it's been great.
Speaking of the universe.
Yes.
The week that I emailed you, so this is literally the week that you got back to me and agreed to do an interview.
Yeah, yeah.
I got an email from a girl called Kim,
and
she didn't know that I'd reached out to you, but can I read you a little bit of what she wanted to know? So she's a listener to Just Make the Thing. Hello, Kim, out
Hi,
there.
Hi, Kim.
She said, I would love to hear an episode on being creative and consistent while living with a chronic disorder. I've lived with chronic muscle pain my entire life, and I'm also hypermobile, and it's made it difficult for me to be consistent in anything. I never know when I'm going to have a bad day that leaves me trapped inside. Do you have advice for someone dealing with a chronic illness who is struggling to keep being consistent with their creativity?
That's a good question, Kim. So one thing I have found is being really open on social media, like having a social media profile, keeps me accountable to other people. So if I am sore, generally someone will say, like my publishers, for example, oh, I told them I was sore. But I was also saying I was pretty sore on Facebook and Twitter. And then they saw that I was sore because I was publicising that, you know, I'm not well at the moment. And then they'd say, we don't want you to do anything. So that was really good. So setting boundaries and being public about those boundaries as well. Doing things that you can do in bed. Like I write in bed. That's where I wrote most of my book. I don't feel guilty about that. You know, I'll go home soon and I've got a phone call to make. I had a job interview in bed once. I had a job interview in hospital once, actually.
Oh, my God.
Or I think I did the application in hospital and then I had the interview afterwards in bed. Just doing things that are comfortable for you and not pushing yourself too much and just setting time aside each day. Like if you take 15 minutes to write or create, that's enough. Not being too hard on yourself. Also, I think listening to podcasts is a really good way of learning and reaching out and connecting with people. So that's really, yeah, that's been one of my saviours where I can listen to like-minded people and learn things without having to do things, you know, go out and socialise or do things when I'm too sore. Connecting with others is really important, like-minded people, you know, other people with chronic illness. There's a really great Facebook group that I'm in, the Freelance Jungle, and a lot of us talk about working freelance with chronic illness. So if Kim's wanting to, I recommend she joins that Freelance Jungle. Just show up however you can, you know, for 15 minutes a day, and if you can do more, then do more. Yeah.
That's such great advice. Yeah. Better to do 10 minutes or 15 minutes mm-hmm. than think it has to be bigger than Ben Hur and then give up.
Yeah, and start. I think just on that, so many people ask me how I can write a book, how they can write a book. You know, they'll tell me I want to write a book, and I said, have you written anything before? And they'll say no, and I said, I don't think writing a book's for you. Like, just start small. Start with the blog. Start with a Facebook post if you don't feel writing is your strength. But don't tackle something that's so big, that's so daunting. Like I just said in my speech earlier, I'm really glad I had that long time in practicing writing and building an audience as well, because I don't think I'd be prepared for perhaps the level of backlash I might get if I hadn't had that online lesson, online resilience building beforehand.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's such great advice. It's that start small and nothing's wasted, right?
Mm-hmm. And just, yeah. You know, I've used Facebook statuses in my book. If I really like them, I've, you know, built a chapter around them, for example.
Mm.
That, you know, it's valuable stuff. Yeah.
It's collecting. Yeah. Like, so you have to feel like a bowerbird.
Yeah,
almost.
Collecting
like picking,
things and yeah. picking where you, yeah. So I think just doing that, making, creating where you can, just, you know, and ask for help as well, or tell people that you can't do it. I had to say no to a lot of things recently, and I think people don't realise what work is. You know, like they'll say, oh, can you promote this event? And I'll say, look, I'm really busy right now. I'm sorry. I'm managing my health and managing work. And then they'll say, oh, it's only sharing a Facebook event. And I'll say, but it's not only sharing a Facebook event. It's more than that.
Mm. Yeah.
So, and how, yeah, and other people, I guess people that are listening to this, don't put your expectations of what you think isn't a lot of work onto people that might not be able to cope so well.
Mm.
Yeah.
How do you say no?
That's hard. I've got a bit of a standard answer now, like, sorry, I can't do it, or it doesn't align with my values, or someone wanted me to be involved in a anti-violence campaign recently, and ordinarily I'd say yes, but I was just so tired with finishing my book, and I'm doing another book now, and I just said, I'm really sorry, you know, I'd like to be involved, but I've got too much on and I don't feel like I can commit to giving this my all. And they were really grateful for that, you know, thanks for being honest. Mm-hmm. Just wishing them the best. I think it's harder to say no to people, like to non-companies, to to individuals. You know, if I say I can't do this right now but message me later, and then they'll be like, oh, I just wanted a quick answer. And some people feel like I've let them down if I haven't given them the answer that they wanted, or given them an answer at all, or if they've said, can you tell me what cream to use for my eczema? And I said, I don't give medical advice and I'll feel really hard done by. So I find that a bit tricky. I'm not very good at saying no. And also I think there's the idea in the arts that if you say no, you'll never be asked again.
That's the fear. Oh, God, I live with that every day. Oh, God, if I say no to this, nothing will ever come again.
The talk that I just did, the company asked me to do Sydney as well, like next week or something, and I said no. I said, I'm on holidays from the 14th and I'm not taking on any new work. And I said, but disability is a perennial topic, so so I will talk to you, to you in the new year. And then today they said, oh, we've got companies all over, so when you're free, let us know. So that was good. So saying no there was good.
Yeah. Well, I guess people respect your boundaries then.
And also saying no, and also I say no to working for free, and sometimes that leads to paid work, which is a bit annoying, and sometimes that's more work in saying no than it is if I just
said yes.
Yes. because a lot of people ask us to work for free and expect it, and especially in disability and arts as well. And when they cross over, then it's doubly. And then I'll give them a whole lecture on why they should pay people, and that's a lot of work. And
yeah. Well, gosh, I could talk to you all day because I have so many more questions.
Oh, go. It's fine.
I wanted to ask you about what you did with the taxi driver.
Oh, yeah. I had a taxi driver incident. This wasn't my first one, but in 2013, a taxi driver, I got in the taxi after a talk and the woman that I was working for said to me, I'll give you a voucher for your taxi. And I said, no, it's fine. I'll get the train. I get it every night. And she said, oh, yeah, I want you to get home safely. I said, okay. All right, so I got in the taxi and he said, oh, what's on your face? And I said, nothing. He said, no, what's on your face? And then he thought whatever was on my face would ruin his car. He said, I don't want you to dirty my seats. And and then he just said, like, I smell. And then he was just really rude. So I got out and I said, fuck you. And then, that happens.
Ballsy, mate. Yeah. Yeah, you really are.
And then because the hotel booked the taxi, we could get his number, and I think he quit. But then I got another taxi, and as I was in the other taxi, I was tweeting what had happened, and I turned that tweet into a blog post, and then it had a huge amount of hits the next day. Then the hotel told me the number of the driver so I could make a complaint to the taxi company. And then the lady that I worked for, Deborah, made a complaint as well, and a few other people because it was on social media. He quit because it ended up in the media. I wrote a story for on News Limited before I wrote a story for Daily Life. Anyway, it was like the top story. It was really weird being the top story on news.com.au. And he, as a result of seeing the media, I think he quit. So there was no reprimand for him or anything. But I used my blog to make the complaints, so I just text in the right bits in the in the complaint form. So I made a complaint to the taxi company, to the taxi commission, and then to the Human Rights Commission, because the taxi company said, until this happens to someone else, we're not going to provide any training. I said, that's ridiculous. Like, you can't let this happen to someone else. Just take this opportunity to provide training. So then we went to the taxi company and made a video with them, and as a result of that, I think the taxi complaints are down. I don't know whether that means incidents are down, be less people complaining, I don't know. But then I think the power of that was to use my blog and social media to to translate that into a complaint, and so more people were aware, more taxi drivers are talking about disability, I think because they expect disability to look a certain way. There's definitely some cultural barriers with understanding disability as well. So it can be really hard. I feel like I've got a better relationship with the taxi company now. They actually sponsored the fashion show that I put on. They gave people taxis, which was really nice. But I do always look in a taxi and see, like, their number before I get in. And I have a lot of trouble when I go to Sydney, actually. Oh, I've got to ring them. I think they think that I'm going to give them some training for free. But every time I go to Sydney to use this certain taxi company, because they're just outside the station, I don't call for one, I always have a hard time because they think that the fare's too short, or they tell me I don't need it. They'll ask me what's wrong, and there's always this nervousness about, whether they'll take me or not. And, yeah, it's just hard. So it's just constant. It's just a constant education.
Does that ever get exhausting?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does.
Constantly educating people?
Yeah, it does. And also I think there's a, like, the onus is often on us to do it, us that have been, like, the subjects of ableism to fight the ableism. So it'd be great if allies can step up, not step in the way or speak up over us, but just, you know, put in that complaint or ask how they can help. I noticed, so just, I don't want to talk about it too much, but I had a really difficult incident with a radio host this year. And after that happened, I noticed that the commentary around it by non-disabled people was incredible, and it showed that people were understanding and understanding that ableism is just as bad as racism and homophobia. And so that was a good outcome because people were talking about it and they were saying this isn't okay. So, yeah, that was a good result.
Yeah, good on you. And, do you want to talk any more about what happened?
Yeah, I just had a difficult experience talking about microaggressions on the radio, and the weird thing is that the interview on the radio demonstrated what those microaggressions was because the host was...
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Being microaggressive,
yeah. So that's been pretty tricky, and I guess I felt like I had to stay in the interview and not be disruptive and be professional. And yes, it's been a tricky thing because I don't even feel like I can speak about it now, but I hadn't been invited back to the ABC for after being a regular guest for a long time, and I felt like they thought I was a risk. Then I got invited back this week, but then my interview was cancelled.
Oh, no.
I don't know what the reason was, but I'm sure it was fine. I don't think it was me. But, yeah, I think, you know, if the apology would be really meaningful if they just had me back and committed to having diverse people on.
Definitely. I saw a quote on your website that says disability is the forgotten part of identity. What do you mean by that?
Well, like I said before, that woman was saying how she often doesn't like the word disability, so she doesn't want to use it. So people just think disability is a fate worse than death, so they don't want to associate, you know, disability in their life. And often we're told to oppress it or suppress it rather. And you know, if I describe myself as a disabled woman, someone will say, "Well, don't do that. You're not disabled like them. Like, that's offensive, or you're not really disabled." Or I'm not comfortable with that word. It's mostly non-disabled people saying this, and they don't see that it's part of identity. Like you said before, it's not my whole part, but it's part of my identity. I don't carry it with me and then put it down at the end of the day. It's always there. But it's you know, it's identity. Like womanhood is like, you know, sexuality, like gender, like race, religion. Yeah, and we're often denied that because of the euphemisms that people use, because of special needs, because of disability, differently abled. Those kinds of words are often used instead of disability. And so that's showing that we're not even allowed to use the words, the factual words that describe us. Yeah, yeah.
I wanted to ask, this is a big question. Planet Broadcasting Network, it strikes me as not being very accessible for everybody, particularly for people, I guess, in terms of people who are deaf. And is there ways that, do you know much about how to do transcribing and how to make things more accessible?
Yeah, you can provide a transcript with every podcast. I know that costs money, but in terms of listenership, it could have a whole new reach. I know that transcription services are like Rev, or I have friends that do it, but certainly, and I need to do it for my own podcast actually, we're looking into that. Making transcripts, inviting different people to come on. So if you had a deaf person, then you'd bring a signer, an Auslan interpreter along who might speak with them. You could also, just find more diverse people to interview. You can do image descriptions on your posts. So I do an image description on my posts on social media. So, for example, if I was to describe how I, like if I put a photo up of myself right now, I would be a woman with a red face, short, dark, curly hair, wearing headphones with a dress with pink horses on it. So, you know, it's not hard to do an image description on each post. It's just, you know, 2 minutes extra. And once you do them, you know, image descriptions are now embedded on Instagram, so you can just do them when you do your Instagram tagging. You can also, yeah, let people know that you're wanting to reach a new community by going out to those communities and talking to them. So telling different communities, you know, like Deaf Arts Network or Vision Australia that you're doing podcasts, yeah, mm-hmm. promoting it to those communities. But just inviting people on and looking at what they're doing. There's a lot of people doing really great creative things. I met a guy the other day who was the official photographer at an event I spoke at, and he was blind, and he was talking about how his photos, how digital photography has opened up the world, because before he couldn't, he saw very narrowly, and now that he could put the memory card into his TV and see the photos he'd taken, he's seeing all these new things that he couldn't see before. That was pretty amazing to hear that. You should get him on the podcast.
Yeah, yeah. He sounds incredible.
Yeah.
Now you've inspired me for 2019.
Right. Also, maybe like a lift or a ramp in your building.
Yeah. Oh, that's a really good point. I'll get on to Evan about that one. Hopefully you're listening, Evan. Yeah, because that is a huge thing, isn't it, with access, with
just
ramps.
Not even being able to get in the door. So, you know, and going to someone, if someone can't come to you, then you can go to someone,
yeah,
with your equipment.
Thank you.
Yeah, and that's all right. And also taking time, you know, like if people need to have a break or if they need the lights down or whatever, if they've got sensory type disability, then yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah, and listening, there's lots of resources online. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, we've got some good work question. To do.
But, I mean, you don't have to do everything, you know, at the start. You can do a few things and, you know, already it will be improvement.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. It's sort of been on my list.
Oh, great.
Okay. So I wanted to finish the interview just mm-hmm. by asking you, what is the thing that brings you the most joy from doing what you do?
Mm. I think it's when people write to me to say, I felt all alone and then until I saw you online or until I read your work and now I realise I'm not. So that's pretty good. Also, you know, if I reach out to a new parent and say, you know, life is going to be hard with ichthyosis, but it'll be okay. And then, like, you know, that kind of stuff's really nice too. A little girl emailed me the other day, I think she's about 12, and she asked for some advice on coping with people's pressures around her ichthyosis. And, like, just being able to share that is nice, yeah.
Oh, thank you, Tali.
That's all right. Thank you.
Oh, thanks for all the work that you do well for all the humans out there who make stuff, because we all need people like you who make so many things out there doing it. So
thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Oh, and where can we find you?
Oh, yeah, I'm at carlyfindlay.com.au or at Carly Findlay on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, I think YouTube. And my book, it's called Say Hello, and it's out on January the 29th, and you can pre-order it now at carlyfindlay.com.au/say hello.
I can't wait to read it. Thank you so much. Okay, bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to a podcast with me, Claire Tonti, called Just Make the Thing, and our guest today was Carly Findlay. You can find more about Carly in our show notes, and she has her book, Say Hello, coming out in January, so definitely grab yourself a copy. You can also submit some writing if you would like to. Carly's part of a project called Growing Up Disabled in Australia, and they're calling for submissions now. So I'll put that website as well in the show notes below. The submissions close in May, and that is for a paid opportunity as well. So there you go. That's a thing that you could get started with right away. Have a great week out there. If you'd like to contact our show, just email justmakethethingpod@gmail.com. We're always after people to advertise on our show, and we'd love questions and topics and for you to write in and share what you're making. If you could as well, subscribe in iTunes, leave us a rating or review. It makes so much difference. It really does. So please go ahead and do that. And you can find more podcasts just like this one at planetbroadcasting.com, which is the Planet Broadcasting podcast network that I run with my husband, James Clement. I've got lots more interviews just like this one as well. So head back through our feed. You'll find wonderful interviews with people like Claire Bowditch, Jamila Rizvi, and also the Teeny Tiny Stevies and lots of other incredible women, as well as comedians like Will Anderson and Luke McGregor and Celia Pacola.
And you can find me at Claire Tonti on Instagram, which is where I like to be. Okay, have a wonderful week. I hope you're enjoying this festive season. I am. Oh my goodness. Next week, Chanel and I are dropping a special Christmas edition. So stick around for that on Christmas Day. And lots of love to you out there, wherever you are. Keep on making. Okay. Till next week. Bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.